Hello and welcome to Indie Business Radio. I'm your host, Donna Maria, and today is Monday, June 29th, and you have arrived at the one place where we empower you to enjoy your life, build your business, and have your way. Well, you know me, I am all about finding some of the most dynamic small business consultants and entrepreneurial experts on the face of the planet, and of course, I am not going to let you down today. I'm very excited to have our guest today on the show. Her name is Lisa Norell. She is the author of the newly published book called Energize Growth Now, The Marketing Guide to a Wealthy Company. Let me tell you a little bit about Lisa. She is a strategic growth expert, consultant, and keynote speaker, as well as the chief energy officer. And I can use some extra energy. She's the Chief Energy Officer of Energize Growth, LLC. An award-winning business columnist, Lisa has written for San Diego's Daily Transcript, Computer World, Custom Builder Magazine, and Women in Technology. And she joins us today to share some of her best tips and experiences consulting with all kinds of companies and getting their tips and the actions that they take to be successful all the time, but especially in a challenging economy like the one we're in today. Lisa, welcome to Indie Business Radio.
Well, thank you for having me, Donna Maria.
Lisa, let's get started by telling me a little bit and our listeners a little bit about your background, who you are, and how did you come into being able to provide good advice for small business owners and entrepreneurs?
Well, you know, it started about 7 years ago. And it was when the wave of scandals happened, Donna Maria, with Bear Stearns, Enron, WorldCom, Adelphia, and the list went on and on. And right about that time, I was also beginning to question my own happiness factor with the company I was with. I was working for a large billion-dollar-plus technology company. I had a fantastic job. I was the first person in the history of the company to build a global account plan for a client, and our client at the time was Microsoft. And great things were happening, except something strange started to happen, and that was that my interest and my passion for my work started to really wane. And this is while I was flying first class around the world, hosting planning sessions, building a great team that was scattered across 8 countries. So all these great things were happening, and my material wealth was growing, but my emotional health was waning. So I said, something has to change. And if it's really this challenging for someone like me who's at the top of her career and is doing great, creating great value for clients, it must be happening for other people as well. So I started on this journey of looking at what does it take to really create a wealthy business, and what really is the definition of a wealthy business. So here we are 7 years later, and thousands of interviews later, I now am pleased that my book has come to fruition and been able to deliver some great guidelines, tips, and tools for people to help define wealth on their own terms.
And one of the things you just mentioned was something called a happiness factor. Can you? I think a lot of our listeners can really relate to that. How did you make the transition, Lisa, from, you know, full-time person who may not have been happy but certainly well-paid, to doing something on your own, which is, you know, a little bit scary?
Well, you know, I was very fortunate. Pretty much my whole career, Donna Maria, I was working for very entrepreneurial companies that gave me a lot of free rein. So for most of my 18 or so years of working in the corporate world, I was more of an intrapreneur, and I had great latitude to build my territories, build my business models, and fail or succeed by the sword, as they say. So that was the first thing, is I was used to having lots of independence and latitude in the companies I enjoyed the most. And I, looking back, what was really interesting about my career was that I have always worked for growth companies. Some of them grew. One of the companies I worked for, I was one of the early employees, and we grew it to about $54 million, sold it to a software company for $268 million. So being part of a team like that and really understand what makes growth companies tick made this, really made my my experience much richer and helped me build the framework for Energized Growth Now.
And Lisa, one of the things you talk about sort of growing out of that is the definition of a wealthy business. You describe that as though it was a term of art. What do you mean by that?
Well, when I talk about wealthy businesses, I'm really defining it quite differently than an attorney, a mergers and acquisitions attorney would, or an accountant would. They look at a whole host of very traditional factors, which are I detail in my book. However, when I look at the companies that have lasting impact and lasting value in the world, and also have extremely happy employees that are committed to the success of the business, they have some things in common. So what I've come up with are seven principles that these firms have in common. And believe it or not, most companies only focus on three or four of the seven.
And let's go through those. Can you share those with us, or just maybe the top two or three of them?
Well, they're really not ranked in any order. So I'll give you all seven, and I'll give you the speed reading version. And then, you know, if we get some inquiries from your Twitter community or your online community, I'm happy to answer some specifics about them.
Okay, great.
The first one is being able to consistently and, most importantly, confidently express and prove your value to the market. You know, one of my mentors, Alan Weiss, says that the first sale is to yourself. And especially for those people who are listening that are running small businesses, let's say your business is under $10 million, it starts with you. You have to really believe the value you're delivering. You have to be able to shed the old belief that you're an hourly employee and your value equates to an hourly rate or an hourly wage. That's a very antiquated model. And some of the things that people are going to hear today and read in my book, Donna Maria, are very contrary to traditional, conventional wisdom about growing a business. The second one is that you're paid handsomely for the value you deliver. And again, you want to look at ways that you can price your services and your products so that you are not bound by your hourly work. The third is being able to continuously innovate. How many of us listening are consistently surveying our clients or our customers and finding out areas of opportunity that are untapped, or looking at new things that we can offer our existing clients? Do you know that's one of the most overlooked areas in today's economy?
Mm-hmm.
Is going back to your existing customers and asking them or educating them on things that you offer that they didn't even know about.
Yeah.
The next is focusing on endeavors that inspire and educate other people. You see, I think that the joy of people starting their own business right now, the part that's really exciting and energizing to me is that so many of us can make a great living inspiring and educating other people. I know that's what you do. And there is an enormous need for education and knowledge for so many different businesses and industries right now. So how can you focus on those types of endeavors that educate and inspire other people? Another principle that I learned from these companies is that their endeavors honor and respect the natural environment. When I really had a great experience. This was, I want to go off the beaten path for a moment. I went on vacation last July, and my husband and I ended up in British Columbia. And we went to the Hollyhock Institute, which is one of the largest adult retreat centers and education centers in Canada. And I was so impressed by the executive director, Dana Bass Solomon, and her commitment to implementing programs that have a minimal impact on the environment. So if any of you are interested in how this really works and what makes an organization successful, there are some tremendous examples in my book about that, and Hollyhock Institute is just one of them. Another is that you have enough of the right clients. Mm-hmm. You know, back in before 2001, growth was about amassing as many customers as you could and generating as much revenue as you possibly could and getting as much funding from the venture community as you possibly could. It was all about volume and massive quantities of revenue. And it was at what expense? Well, it wasn't always about having a great loyal set of clients as a result of that. It was about maximizing your valuation so you could go public. Now you're seeing a throttling back of that, and you're seeing people starting to say, I want to make sure we have the right clients. Because if we have a lot of unhappy clients, the word will spread like wildfire on the internet and through other social media channels. We can't afford to bring in the wrong customers. We have to have loyal ones. Mm-hmm. And the customers become some of our best salespeople as a result.
Okay.
And the final principle is providing your people with enough time for family, friends, and personal growth. One of the clients that we work with that we showcase in the book is Jeldwen Communities, and they actually have incentives for their employees to spend time in the community and spend time helping their favorite charities and nonprofits. Mm-hmm. So it's really something to look at in your own business. What am I doing to ensure that a portion of my time and my own energy is investing in my professional growth as well as in my community and with my family and friends? So those are some of the common wealth-building traits that these successful, energized companies had in common.
Lisa, I enjoyed each and every one of them, and I have a question about what you think about them. I'm curious to know whether you think that enough companies are doing these things, because it seems to me that everything that you just mentioned, you know, you look at it and you go, well, that's good and that's good, and of course I want to do that, of course we want to do that. Why is it that more companies don't operate in the ways you just described?
Well, I think one of the reasons is that, first of all, planning and marketing is not their core strength. I think that many times people think of growth planning and marketing as something that is often intermingled with or confused with advertising. And worse than that, what they do, Donna Maria, is they delegate, or I should say abdicate, the marketing and planning to the marketing department. And in reality, companies that have the privilege of becoming growth companies and get past that startup phase have made marketing and planning everybody's business. And, you know, that's what the difference is in the companies that I looked at. And that's where you know, listeners have the potential of becoming growth companies when they really take planning and marketing as seriously as they do other functions in their business.
Well, Lisa, one of the things your book talks about, actually this is in the foreword, I want to read this because I think it's really on point for small business owners, and then we're going to take a short break and come back and talk about it. It's from the foreword, which is, by the way, by Guy Kawasaki, and it says, if you have survived the initial startup phase of your business, it's easy to abdicate positioning and planning to others so that you can keep pursuing new projects for new businesses. Planning cramps your style. Don't fall prey to this temptation. When we come back from our break, Lisa, I'd like to pick your brain a little bit about how important it is to keep the distractions at bay and stay focused on your course so you don't fall victim to what's described here. And I know your book goes into a great deal of detail about that, but I think that this is something that startup businesses struggle with significantly. So we're going to come back and talk with Lisa Norell, author of Energized Growth Now, The Marketing Guide to a Wealthy Company, when we come back from our break. This is Indie Business Radio. I'll be right back.
why is everyone listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com? Because it's the future of talk radio. Every day, more and more people are finding internet radio as not just an alternative media, but as a replacement to traditional AM and FM broadcast stations. Internet radio offers a wider variety of programs, convenient on-demand listening that meets your schedule, and fewer commercial interruptions. And GlobalTalkRadio.com is already leading the way by matching this content with a highly targeted internet audience. GlobalTalkRadio.com offers its listeners one of the widest programming varieties on the internet, from business and finance to self-improvement, paranormal, health, literature, romance, politics, and more. There are also opportunities for prospective hosts who would like to host their own weekly or one-time talk shows. Want to learn more? Check us out at www.globaltalkradio.com and see the future of talk radio today.
Welcome back to Indie Business Radio. I'm here today talking with Lisa Norell, the author of Energize Growth Now, the Marketing Guide to a Wealthy Company. And before we took our first break, Lisa, we were talking about the importance of startups not losing that spark, that energy that gets things started, because it's so hard to keep that going once you kind of get into the groove. Give us your best tips for staying, as your book says, energized about your business when it becomes sort of ho-hum and you're managing things and you're doing the same thing over and over and over again. Help us stay motivated.
Well, first of all, and you know, Donna Maria, the one thing we cannot do is rely on others to motivate us. That's the first rule. I really cringe when I do keynote speaking engagements and people say, "We need your help to motivate our people." And I say, look, if you're an entrepreneur, you either have systems and rituals in place to motivate yourself, or your business is never going to make it.
Well, let's talk about that then, because if that's the key, to put systems and rituals in place for ourselves, give me some examples of small business owners, and I'm talking small here, like one and two people, maybe with a couple of contractors. What are some of your best examples of some of the clients you've worked with who've been able to do that successfully?
Well, one of the companies that we work with currently is on the East Coast in Pennsylvania, and they're a technology company. It was a family-owned business. It was started by a gentleman, and his son eventually took over the business. And one of the things that, to give you a contrast, is when he approached us 2.5 years ago, he said, "I just can't figure out why my people are not understanding our priorities. We're having communications breakdowns, and we are unable to get things done around here." Well, what we found is that he, along with many of his executives, struggled from something that many single-person businesses also can struggle with, and it's called shiny penny syndrome. And shiny penny syndrome happens when you are walking along the sidewalk, and instead of enjoying the beautiful scenery and listening to the traffic behind you and looking out for your landmarks that you're aiming for, you're focusing on the sidewalk and you're getting distracted by shiny pennies. And many of us that start our businesses fall prey to shiny penny syndrome. And it's very easy to get distracted. That's why I think social media has value, but it also has its place. And it can be a huge time-sucking machine and take you away from having serious or valuable relationships with other people. So we have to be careful for what things we're doing on a regular basis that are either serving our core business or distracting us from our core business. And this, as I said, this can happen with a one-person business or with a client like ours on the East Coast that now is in 3 countries and has 300 employees. Size doesn't matter. It's more of being mindful of your mindset.
And I love what you said earlier, Lisa, about the importance for, as you call it, a quote-unquote wealthy business, the importance of focusing on the select customers that you can serve best and generate the best and most fair profit from, and not try to serve everyone. Can you talk a little bit about how business has transitioned in that regard?
Well, I think, I'm not sure if there's been a transition as much as there has been much more of a desire by business owners to work with really great clients. And as I did some research here and also looked at the success of my existing client base, I said, you know, there are some things that these companies have in common. One is that they are not only clear on who their ideal client is, but they have it written down. Their brand is very, very clear, and they're communicating that brand across every single touch point that where they come across someone in the public. And when we talk about brand touch points, I know you'll probably see this in your book, your copy of the book, Donna Maria, where everything you do that touches another person is a reflection of your company brand. And so you've got to make sure that it's touching those ideal clients. It can be your fax cover sheet, your press releases, your community outreach or company community events, how you answer your phone, anything that touches another person who might be a potential client. So anytime a company begins to really define that perfect client, both how they operate emotionally, as well as some of their demographic characteristics, they start to see a number of major benefits. Number one, their selling cycles are shorter. Number two, their cost of client acquisition, in other words, the cost of actually going out and getting a client, is much lower. Mm-hmm. Their brand starts to carry a premium price, which helps downstream when they want to potentially sell the business. And another benefit is that that brand creates more repeat business with less effort. So there are a lot of benefits to really understanding who that perfect client is, and most importantly, who your ideal client is not.
So let's talk about that a little bit then. It sounds like that kind of goes to the point of not being all things to all people.
Yes, you're so right. I still cringe.
Let me ask it this way, Lisa, because when I work with small business owners and I really want to hone in on the tiny, tiny startups, the ones who are bootstrapping, the ones who are one, maybe two people, and one is their spouse, you know what I mean? Just really, really got something really good going, a good product, it's innovative, it's exciting, there is, you know, they believe in it and they're willing to roll up their sleeves and work really hard to get their businesses, you know, to break even and then, of course, become profitable. What I want you to address is the mindset of making sure that just because you love what you do, you don't fall victim to loving it so much that you lose sight of actually working it as a business. Do you know what I mean? When I was a little girl, my mother sews beautifully. She makes quilts. I mean, she sells them for her church on eBay for like over $1,000.
Oh, my goodness.
That's how beautiful these things are. When I was a little girl, I used to say, Mom, you know, this is great. You can make some money on this. Why don't you start a business? And she said, no, I don't want to start a business. That's too much work. And I remember thinking, but you're doing all the work, and you could just, like, sell it and make some money, and, you know, then I could have lots of toys. You see, my mother. But I remember now, as a business owner, I remember what she said. And so a lot of business owners, Lisa, maybe you agree with this, they kind of go into it. They're so excited. Their quilts are great. Whatever it is they're making is fantastic. They don't realize that once they start doing it over and over again, it's not as much fun anymore. Can you talk a little bit about how we can really sort of start our businesses with that understanding so that we're not surprised by it?
Well, the first thing that people have to do is make a real choice, and that is, what do I want to create here? I have an 11-step planning process that a startup can use, but also a growth company can use. And if you just take a pause and ask yourself, what is my vision for this business?
Mm-hmm.
What do I want it to become? You know, maybe I don't want to run a business. Maybe I want to do some part-time handiwork. Maybe if I'm a beauty salon owner, I don't want to hire anyone. I just want it to be me and maybe another person. There is no judgment around that. But if you really want to create a business that's wealthy, that might be worthy of eventual sale or exit, then you have to have a serious conversation about your vision for this company and where it could possibly go.
So when we start, we need to focus not only on what we want to do, but what we want to be doing 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years from now.
Yes. And even if you can plan out 2 or 3 years, you're well ahead of your competitors.
Let's talk about that. Are you saying that most people don't do this?
Only the majority.
Oh, so we have a competitive advantage if we adopt this mindset.
Okay. And the other thing is that there is scientific evidence that I talk a lot about in my book and with my clients that just by writing down these 11 steps and understanding where you're taking the business, what you stand for, who your perfect client is, what some of your internal and external constraints are, just by understanding some of these key elements and getting them written down, you are allowing your brain to start filtering and prioritizing so that you indeed focus on what's important.
So
it's amazing.
Writing it, so the business planning process, even though as a small business owner you don't need like a billion pages and a three-ring binder and a bunch of charts and graphs, right? The benefits of writing these things down, but they help us be accountable. They help us actually achieve what it is that we write down that we want.
Right, absolutely. I mean, Albert Einstein once said that the significant problems we face cannot be solved by the same level of thinking that created them, Donna Maria. And it's actually proven scientific wisdom, or there's actual proven research that shows that just by having a structure and writing down these basic 11 steps, it begins to create and help you, your brain, prioritize what needs to be done and what doesn't, and it's called the filtering process. It's fascinating, fascinating scientific studies out there right now. It's called, this in particular is called the reticular activation system.
Well, we'll have to make sure we explore that more fully in the book. And I love what you just said about the power of actually writing things down. I know for me, writing things down and putting them up, like, you know, on a piece of paper on my refrigerator, my microwave oven, in my office, and kind of every place, really does reinforce the vision over time. It's very powerful.
It really is.
So thank you for sharing that. Now, Lisa, we are in the middle of what other people call a recession. Like so many people I know, you probably, like me, aren't participating in it. But having said that, times are a little bit different now. Are there some special things that successful companies are doing to ride this out so that they come out at the other end of it better positioned to take advantage of a better economy?
Well, first of all, I go back to what we discussed earlier, and that is what your mindset is and what your belief system is about the current state of affairs. And I think we first have to arm ourselves with evidence and recognize that some of the best companies that we all know and love today were founded during a recession.
Give us an example or two of those.
Well, if you go to my blog, which is blog.energizegrowth.com, I actually wrote about this, and there's an article that and some great research out of the Kellogg School of Management that shows that companies such as CNN, Apple, Federal Express, Microsoft, and Hyatt were all founded during bad economic times. And in fact, there are studies that back this up that say that many companies saw their market share grow up to 2.5 times over their competitors who had cut back on marketing and didn't do any planning at all. And that was a study that was generated in 2001. So it's amazing to me how many people and how many company executives really, you know, they found ways to be even more innovative and creative during tough times.
Lisa, we are going to take our next and final break, and we're going to come back and talk with you some more about your book, Energize Growth Now, The Marketing Guide to a Wealthy Company. Thanks for joining me, everyone. Lisa Norell is really providing some great tips for us today. We're going to come right back after this last break. This is Indie Business Radio. Don't touch that mouse.
Want to stay on top of what's new in the radio industry? Sign up for a free subscription to the Future of Talk Radio, available exclusively to listeners of globaltalkradio.com, and find out what's new in the world of online radio. Listeners can find out about new shows and special guests. People with something special to offer can find out how to become a guest and how to prepare for an interview. And prospective hosts will find a valuable resource for everything from planning their new program to selecting topics and guests, recouping expenses by selling advertising, and more. Sign up today for your free subscription to the Future of Talk Radio by visiting www.globaltalkradio.com and learn about the future of talk radio today.
Welcome back to Indie Business Radio. I'm here with Lisa Norell, author of Energize Growth Now, The Marketing Guide to a Wealthy Company. And one of the things Lisa said before we took our last break was that the companies in prior recessions that have come out the most successfully have been the ones who don't decrease their marketing during the tough times. They increase it. So, Lisa, here's the elephant in the room. We're small business owners. We're determined, as just like any other business owner is, but the marketing budget is really slim. Help us understand how we can increase our marketing activities using today's technologies so we can come out on the other end of this tough economic time better positioned to take advantage of the good times.
Well, are you speaking here particularly, Donna Maria, about social media and how it can be leveraged, or are you speaking about technology in general?
Well, it actually could be anything that we can use to market. And I know that social media tools are great ways to market, but there may be some other ones that don't really fit that definition that I'd be happy for you to share with our listeners today.
Well, the first thing we have to look at is, remember, I went back on the, when I was talking about wealth building principles, one of the things that wealthy companies do well is they focus on endeavors that inspire and educate other people, right? Mm-hmm. So what we have to look at is what are we selling or marketing, and where do our ideal clients spend their time? So when it comes to social media, if we want to really narrow it down, we have to really first look at whether our clients and our influencers, those people who actually tell others about our great services and products, even spend time there. And I dedicated a whole chapter in my book to the topic of social media. So first of all, by defining it properly, social media is a category of web-based tools that facilitate information sharing. So you really, even though it's really attractive and it gives you a lot of freedom and flexibility and allows users to generate their own content and comments about you, you have to first of all determine if your clients even care. Now, if you're selling products to end users, let's say that you own a beauty shop or you sell very expensive high-end quilts, which I think you mentioned earlier, social media can probably be quite useful for you. But in my case, I sell high-end services to a limited number of growth company CEOs and their executive teams, and that's a business-to-business venue. And in that case, social media is still a very young industry, and a lot of C-level executives and business buyers are not yet really fully leveraging social media. So you have to take a very pragmatic approach to using social media in that particular sector. So that's the first thing that I encourage people to look at.
So you kind of want to invest the time to figure out where your ideal customers are and then see how they interact at those locations, and then you can participate with them there? Is that kind of a summary of what it boils down to?
Yes, and bottom line is, before you invest more than 10 to 20 minutes a day maximum on any social media activity, ask yourself, am I doing this because it makes me feel good, or am I doing this because my clients and influencers are spending lots of time in that particular social media venue? And be very discerning and pragmatic about it. And I offer, I have 11 strategies to help people actually build a social media plan before they dive in headfirst.
Good. And this is in your book?
Yes.
Excellent. So, you know, and that's such an interesting point. Now, let me ask you this, because what one of the things I'm noticing, and maybe you are too, I'd love to know if you are, is that there is it seems to be a continual, gradual blurring between, for small business owners, between our professional lives and our personal lives in places like Facebook and on places like Twitter. I think I sometimes call it like perso-professional, because because there's so much of us that is our business, and there's so much of our business that is us. Can you give us some of the things that you've noticed about how successful companies, you know, integrate their two lives? I think about someone like Zappos, who is, of course, the company that sells shoes online and does such a fantastic job. Well, Zappos' CEO is, Twitters personally quite frequently and regularly. And he doesn't just tweet about his business. He tweets about what he's doing, who he's having dinner with, and things like that. So I would imagine that 20 minutes, if it was calculated just for specific business, would be a lot less than he actually spends, but he gets some business benefit out of it. Do you see what I mean?
I do. I definitely see what you mean. And again, Zappos, and I spent a day with Tony and his team, and I have some actual video clips of those interviews in my blog, and I learned a great deal from that. Again, let me stress, that is a consumer products business. That is not business-to-business interaction. So they're building their brand and building raving fans, present company included, as a result of building that more personal touch with their customers and their online community. I think last time I checked, Tony had over 750,000 followers on Twitter.
Is that not totally amazing? And you're right about the present company. I love their customer service. But let's focus in on that, Lisa, because our listeners today, generally, not all of them, but the vast majority deal in that world. They are business owners selling a commodity, and specifically bath and body care products, health and beauty products, to consumers. So what are some of the things you learned from Zappos that any small business owner selling again to consumers can employ to maximize Twitter like he is?
Well, when I was there, I was focused more on their growth strategy as opposed to the tactical uses of Twitter. Mm-hmm. So I take a contrarian view on this, and I say before we get all enamored with the tips on how to use Twitter, we have to ask ourselves some very important questions.
Okay.
First of all, am I doing this to communicate, converse, and build strong communities of raving fans of my products and services? Am I using it in an ethical way? Are these venues that I'm selecting, whether it's Facebook, MySpace, Ning, Twitter, am I joining the right communities where I actually can contribute and make a difference and go back to inspiring, educating, and informing others?
Mm-hmm.
I have to ask those questions first before I get lulled into spending thousands of dollars or, you know, joining up and going to seminars on how to be a better tweeter. Because many business owners don't take that extra time on the front end to actually define what the purpose is of having a social media strategy.
This this is so good. I think what you said bears repeating. Some of the questions we can ask ourselves, and then the time we have left, we can talk a little bit about this. Am I involved in this particular social media outlet to build strong communities of fans of my product? So taking a look at that, it sort of forces you to look inside yourself and make sure that your participation is actually designed to share information that people will repeat. Is that kind of what you mean, that they will share with each other naturally?
Absolutely. Okay. And you have to pick what the purpose is of your strategy in the first place before you randomly start tweeting about what you had for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And so make sure you pick the purpose and you stick with that as you're building that online community. You're either going to do it to create an interactive forum where your clients can post questions. You're going to have a cause that you're really passionate about where you want to gather signatures and commitments. You want to engage people and create an engagement site where you do surveys and polls. You may want to use it to create a shopping mall and post coupons like Seventh Generation does so brilliantly on their website. Or you may just want to create a social media site to broadcast your seminars or events of interest. And, you know, Guy Kawasaki does that incredibly well on his blog. And I use my blog primarily for engagement and to share new ideas and gather feedback. So you have to really, again, think like a growth company. Think like a strategist and pick your purpose first.
And so you look inside yourself. You, of course, know your customers first. You know your market. You know what it is you're trying to sell to whom, right? And then you can take a look at everything from, as you said, you have a blog or these other sorts of social media outlets, and there's no shortage of them to choose from. But I think we can kind of narrow it down to four or five that seem to be the most popular, right? And then, as you say, you make sure that you have a strategy. What goals do you want to accomplish by sharing information with people at these places? And then you kind of go from there. And I guess you have to massage it a little bit as you go, right? Because do you find that what happens is you're involved there, and then the people who are engaging with you kind of tell you what they're interested in, and you kind of follow that?
Yes, and you can do that. Again, it depends on what your purpose is for being active in a social media site.
Okay.
I was just going to say that it really depends on whether you are doing this to strengthen a cause that you're passionate about, where you may upset people and create a lot of polarization in that particular space, or if you're using it to get people galvanized around a cause that they already believe in, and you're just kind of following their patterns or their trail of discussion.
And you know, Lisa, the reason I've picked up on this, as you can probably tell, is because our listeners are very small business owners. And, I mean, the website may be fabulous, right? It may be perfectly, lovely product photos. The shopping cart works like magic. It's perfectly user-friendly and looks great. The challenge on the Internet today, though, is getting people to go there, right?
Yes.
And it's not enough to say, I sell great shoes or I have wonderful lip balm. That's not enough anymore. So the reason I'm asking these questions about these other tools is because they can be used, can they not, to get people to become interested in what it is that you do have at your website and what you offer there.
That's right. That's right. It's, again, if you're inspiring, educating, and informing,
okay,
that in itself might be enough of a purpose for having a good blog and inviting people to comment on your information or provide feedback on a survey that you're conducting.
Inspire, educate, and inform. You know, I think that is sort of almost in a nutshell a good summary of what your book talks about in terms of how we energize ourselves. I would imagine if you are inspiring, educating, informing, that's, you can get a huge amount of energy from that because people will tell you, that was so helpful. I learned a lot from that blog post. And is that the kind of momentum that sort of gets that engine going and keeps everything on a forward motion basis?
You know, it really is, Donna Maria. And remember that when someone says that really was a helpful tip or your product really was terrific, your follow-up question, especially as a startup, always has to be, would you be willing to tell others about it? Would you be willing to blog about it on your blog? Would you be willing to write an article about it to your community? And find those influencers that are willing to spread the word for you. You don't have to do it alone.
Ooh, now that's scary for a lot of people. So in our final moments, let's get some tips for doing that, because I think sometimes people feel like, you know, well, you know, the person's already read my blog and left a great comment. Now I'm going to go back to them and say, hey, you know, you got another 10 minutes in your life to help me, you know, share what I'm doing. How can we ask that question in a way that doesn't seem pushy or presumptuous, Lisa?
Well, we first have to go back to the early discussion we had about what stops people. And this one took me 24 years to figure out that there are really only two things, bottom line, that will stop our listeners from succeeding in their business. One is lack of an easy-to-understand written plan. And the second are limiting beliefs. And that limiting belief that I will hear often from a startup business owner is, oh, I could never toot my own horn. That sounds so presumptuous of me. Oh, my goodness. I'm not good enough to do that yet. No one's going to listen to me. Mm-hmm. And on and on and on. You know, fill in the blanks. Mm-hmm. And I actually have come up with a list of these limiting beliefs because they're so common. Mm-hmm. So let's revel in the fact that we all at some point in our business are going to have some limiting beliefs about our potential, and make sure that we recognize them, own up to them, and using some basic questions that I outline in my book, find a way to make light of them, address them, and cut them off at the pass. Because there are many people listening that have some great business ideas and some great products. And the dream of running a successful, energized growth company is alive and well. If you just simply take the time to learn how to plan for it, and believe in yourself.
Planning and belief in yourself. So at some point, you kind of just got to close your eyes and do it. Whether it feels good, whether it feels right, you just do it. And you worry about all the, as you said, cut it off at the pass and just go for it.
Absolutely. The universe rewards action. And, that's why if you're not in action and moving that ball forward a few inches every day, you can't move your company forward.
Right. The universe rewards action. So I guess procrastination will kill everything faster than just about anything else.
Absolutely it will. We've all had that problem somewhere in our careers, I'm sure.
And as
again,
you say, cutting it off at the pass.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Lisa, this has been great. I can't believe we've come to the end of our time together. Lisa Norell, the author of Energize Growth Now, The Marketing Guide to a Wealthy Company. Lisa, tell us where we can go on the Internet to get more information about you, and if you're going to be speaking anywhere soon, tell us where that's going to be so we can go check you out.
Well, thank you. Yes, my website, again, is energizegrowth.com. I have some excerpts of my book at blog.energizegrowth.com, so I invite people to sign up for the normal feeds. The book's available now through all online booksellers and outlets, so feel free to pick up a copy. And I think the best way for people to keep in touch is through my website, or if they like the old-fashioned telephone, I'm happy to leave my phone number with people as well. It's 541-593-8787. As far as my speaking engagements, you can just go to energizegrowth.com and click on the news and events page, and that is updated weekly with my speaking schedule.
Thank you for that information, Lisa. No shortage of ways to get in touch with Lisa, and that's so great because everybody does prefer a different kind of means of communication. So thank you for sharing that, Lisa. And thank you for joining today. Thank you for listening today. It's been great to have you here. I want to let you know that next week on July the 6th, David Meerman Scott will be here for the second time. He is the author of a recently released book called Worldwide Rave, and he's going to be joining us to share how you can engage the global community in a worldwide conversation about your brand. I think it's the perfect show to follow up on some of the things that Lisa was talking about, how we can use these different social media and technological tools to share information, inspire, and encourage others, as Lisa said, and get people talking about what we're doing. Fantastic stuff coming up here on Indie Business Radio. I hope you guys have a great holiday. The 4th of July is coming out. Happy birthday, America, and have a great week, everyone. I will see you next week on July the 6th. In the meantime, enjoy your life, build your business, and have your way.
You're listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com.